Okay, let's get going with hour number three on this Wednesday night. This is the third book in a series. It's called Missing 411, Missing 411, North America and Beyond. Stories, these are strange stories, of people who have flat disappeared in remote locations of North America and five other countries. The author is David Politis, and he is back with us tonight to talk about his brand new book and has given us 2 hours of very intriguing conversation in the past. How are you, Dave? Welcome back.
I'm doing great, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Good. I noticed Whitley Strieber wrote the back cover endorsement for the book.
He did?
Yeah. You ought to look at the back of the book sometime. Remember Whitley?
I know Whitley well.
I'm kidding. All right. I had known Whitley for a long time. I had dinner with Whitley once years ago. He says, David has shined a light onto one of the greatest and most disturbing mysteries of our time, the simple and awful fact that people disappear, especially in our national parks, and little effort, if any, is made to find them, let alone inform the public about the danger. Even when massive searches are mounted and people are found, the events surrounding their loss and recovery are often far beyond logical explanation. This is the most comprehensive and expertly presented series of books on this subject ever written, and this latest volume, which includes stories from five countries, is sobering, chilling, and far too well researched to ignore. It is essential reading. Whitley Strieber. All right, this is Missing 411. This book seems to be bigger than the other ones.
Yeah, you know, I got rolling on it, and I didn't realize how big it was. And there's a lot of information in there. We happen to get data from other countries, so that was something that was new and unexpected, and it just grew to the size it is today.
How? What were the five other countries, first of all?
So it's a thrush of Europe, some couple of islands off of India, and Malaysia. And it's probably something that I had never heard of before, and some people sent me some information about an incident, and it started with France along a river in the late 1950s. A woman was walking along a river there, and she felt as though some kind of force came over her and grabbed her from behind. She could see a dark-colored, huge hand grab her upper chest and start to drag her into a thorny bush area. She started to scream. She heard a voice up above her say something. And at about that time, the weather started to change. It started to thunder, rain, and it was immediate. And the voice said something like, "Well, here you go," as though he's delivering her to somebody. And then all of a sudden, everything stopped, and she ran to a nearby farm. And the farmer said that he could see a large hand that had grabbed her chest, and there was a red mark there. They called the police. The police wrote a report about it. And the elements of that incident mimic 80% of what I write about in the three books.
That's spooky stuff. She was lucky.
Very lucky.
This suggests an abduction of a paranormal caliber. And I wonder if you see a pattern over time, where the same kind of thing, maybe there are abductions of people being perpetrated by a group or something, a consciousness. She couldn't see what it was, but she felt it.
And could hear it.
Yeah.
So one of the things that kind of got us all rolling years ago was that after you review hundreds and hundreds of cases where people disappear in the woods and you read reports that are emanated by that Freedom of Information Act and media reports, we started to see the same sort of things time after time after time. Namely, when a search is started, canines won't track or can't find a track.
Sometimes I remember that from our other visits, yeah.
Exactly. Sometimes you bring the canine to the scene and they'll just lay down, or they'll walk in circles and lay down. A lot of times after the person disappears, there's a bad weather-related event that impugns the progress of the search team. All of these are rural, and we eliminate all possibility if it's a drowning or a possible suicide or it's a possible animal attack. Dogs are involved in a lot of these cases, meaning that people disappear with their dogs. An abnormal amount of these cases involve disabled people. It seems that many times when you get to the seventh, eighth day and law enforcement can't find the people, mm-hmm. in almost every one of these cases, they start talking about kidnapping or abduction. And that's law enforcement talking about that.
All right, you just said two words, kidnapping and abduction. What's the difference in those two words to you, Dave?
I don't really know if there is one. I think they're somewhat synonymous. I think with kidnapping, people tend to think there's some reward at the end of the tunnel.
Uh-huh.
And whereas an abduction, there might not be any reward that's ever generated. But the differences are subtle.
Got it. Okay. Well, abduction, of course, has that other connotation that suggests an off-planet abduction. And we don't know about that either. I guess what we have to say here is that there are so many different kinds of things that have happened to people, it's almost impossible to rule anything out.
Well, sometimes I like to deviate actually away from what I write and refer to what others have written in kind of support of what our theories are.
Yeah.
And there was an article in OregonLive.com in June 8th this year where the writer talked about the enormous amount of disappearances in the woods of Oregon. And a staggering 189 men, and this is their words, a staggering 189 men and 51 women officially remain listed as missing since 1997 by the Oregon Office of Emergency Management.
That's too many.
It's enormous.
That's too many. That's 15 years. That's too many.
And then they go on and they talk about the type of people that have gone missing. And there's two people that have gone missing in the same area just recently, and that's in the Three Sisters Wilderness area.
That's by Bend, Oregon.
Right. And there's one of the guy's moms, a woman named Cynthia Boucher, 66, from Vancouver, said, "There is a mystery here. Both Jake and Professor Daming Zhu were experienced hikers on wilderness trails.
Mm-hmm.
Two grown men can't simply disappear from the mountain 5 years apart."
No. I don't know where you are on. We know where Whitley is on the whole UFO thing, but is it on the table with you that some of these disappearances might be chalked up to ET abductions? We do know cattle mutilations have occurred, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, not just cows, llamas, pigs, sheep, horses, people. They've all been mutilated in the same fashion. It's if we are being watched, biological work is being done on in a fatal, terminal way on many kinds of life forms on this planet. And abductions could be in there too, couldn't they?
So people who have followed the books and followed my interviews, I don't discount anything and I don't point a finger at anything.
That's right. Now, you've been extremely professional about this whole thing. It'd be very easy for you to go in one direction or another, but you will not do that.
But I should tell people that it's been almost four and a half years now since we started, and since I was first on your show.
And you're kidding me.
It's been a long time.
Jeez.
And one of the things I think that you get when you're in our position is you get a lot of emails from people who have a lot of theories.
Yeah.
And I could tell you that we've had probably 10 term paper length responses as to what's happening here.
And no kidding. Well, there's another book.
No, well, it's staggering what the amount of has been generated by people on this, and I think all the people are passionate, all of them are informed, and I think that we all go to that place in our mind that we know the most about. If you know the most about UFOs, maybe you go there. If there's another crypto topic, maybe you go there. And if you're a conspiracy believer and you think that the government might be taking us, maybe you go in that area.
And you got the satanic cult abductions as well. That's another one.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But I think that it's hard to pin one culprit in these because they're so vast. And right now we've identified 34 clusters of these missing people in the U.S. and Canada.
34. Now, remember what I just said. In 15 years, approximately, what, 230 people, 50-some men and 100 and, what'd you say? I forget the rest.
189 men.
189 men. Okay. That's 240 people in 15 years have flat vanished from the Oregon wilderness or hiking trails or national parks. Now, as David and I have talked about in the past, the National Park Service is, shall we say, reticent to talk about this stuff, to put it mildly. We'll discuss a little bit about that as we continue. The book is called Missing 411, and I would urge all of you to read it. It is, especially if you go to national parks. I don't want you to be scared and not go, but you need to have this knowledge before you go. All right? We'll be right back. Okay, back with David Politis, and the book is Missing 411. Stories, strange stories of people, just normal folks, who have disappeared instantly in remote locations of North America and five other countries as well. Okay, so, where do you want to go from here?
Well, so the people who haven't heard me before, I'll kind of give you that Reader's Digest version of how we got started is, years ago, I was in a national park doing some peripheral research and went back to my hotel at the end of the night, got a knock on the door, a couple people standing there. They said they knew who I was. They were watching me in the park and they knew my work and they had read some of my other books and they said that they had a story to tell and they thought that someone ought to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who don't know, national park rangers tend to move park to park, monument to monument every 7 to 8 years in a career. They may be in 4 or 5 different locations.
Mm-hmm.
These people were senior people, and they said that at the places they were at, there was an abnormal amount of missing people. And then at the front end, when the people originally disappeared for that first 7 days, there was a lot of publicity, there was a lot of follow-up, there was a big effort.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, nothing. And when they tried to follow up and see what happened, they were stonewalled, and they thought that there were an abnormal amount in the parks themselves rather than in the surrounding area, which really was no different than the park. And they said that somebody ought to look into it, somebody with some law enforcement background. So they gave me the info. I drove out of the park. I called some law enforcement people right away, and I said, hey, can you see if there's a lot of people missing from these areas? They called me back in an hour and said, wow, there's something here. Went back home, filed a series of Freedom of Information Act requests against the National Park Service, specifically asking them for a list of the missing people from their system, 189 different parks and monuments, and then a specific list of the missing people from Yosemite National Park. And within about 2 weeks, I got a response that there are no lists of any missing people in the Park Service, either individually or cumulatively, and they were sorry that they couldn't fulfill my request.
Did you laugh or were you just disgusted?
Well, we were sitting in a room with three people, and we both thought it was maybe something in the semantics, the way we wrote the request, that we wrote a second one.
Yeah.
And we got that back about a month and a half later and said, no, we understood your first one. There are no lists. There never have been any lists.
Lies. Mm.
So then we said, well, because I was a published author, according to the Freedom of Information Act, there is an author's exemption that you can apply for. We applied for it and said we wanted a list of missing people from Yosemite and from your entire system.
Mm-hmm.
They came back, and this time an attorney called me from the National Park Service, which is always an interesting call.
Yeah.
And he said, first of all, why do you want the information? For your listeners out there that follow and understand the Freedom of Information Act, that is an inappropriate question if it's dealing with their response and whether they're going to give you the information or not. They can't ask that.
Right.
So I explained that I was an author. I was doing some research on a topic. I just wanted the info. And he said, well, we're not going to give you the author's exemption. And his response was, because your books aren't in enough libraries.
Oh, yeah, Jesus.
And I've never heard that before, and we've looked it up, had an attorney look it up, and he says...
You won't hear it again either.
Bogus.
Disgusting.
But he says, I'm going to give you a response where you can get it. He says, if you want the list from our entire system, it's going to cost you and your organization $1.4 million. And if you want it from Yosemite, it's only going to be $34,000.
Uh-huh. So he admitted there was a list, a comprehensive list, and you could get it for $1.4. What a joke. What a joke. Now, Yosemite is extremely well-traveled, well-visited. And I can't imagine that there are that many. We've talked before about people who have vanished from Yosemite. But that's a place that it's hardly out in the boondocks in terms of national parks. It's right there.
You would think so. But phenomenally, many of the cases that I've written about in books involve people staying in the valley floor, telling their relatives that we're just going to take a short walk and we'll be back in an hour. And those people are gone, and they're never, ever found.
And some people are gone, and I don't want to steal your thunder here, who go for a walk, and literally, within a minute or two, they're gone forever and ever and ever.
And that's part of the mystery behind this, and part of the one of the consistent elements that are in many of these cases. One of the things in the latest book that I write about is the educational background of many of the people that have disappeared and have never been found, and no evidence of them ever being in that area have ever been found. And that is that many of these people are genius-level people. A couple of the ones that have disappeared in the Oregon area, Daming Zhu was a math professor at the University of Oregon. One of the most recent disappearances, Hildegard Hendrickson up in Washington, was a retired professor from the University of Washington in economics and finance. And I could go on and on, but going back to Yosemite, in the 1950s, a guy who was a grad student at UC Berkeley disappeared when he was with his family and just said, told his family, I'm going to take a walk for an hour, I'll be gone. He disappeared, was never found. 2 months later, another family with another University of California graduate student, same exact scenario, disappears and is never found. The follow-up investigations showed that these two people didn't know each other, weren't in the same same background, they weren't in the same programs, they didn't run in the same circles, nothing. The families got together and wrote a letter to Eisenhower and said, there is no way our kids disappeared voluntarily. They asked for special forces to come into the park and search because they believed the kids were abducted. There wasn't a response.
Even back then, wow.
Even back then.
This must really bother you. You must be haunted at some time when you dream about this. This is weird. And you're a former law enforcement officer. This has to have a very heavy impact on you.
You know, the heavy impact really comes into play when you're dealing with kids that are between 18 months and 5 and 6 years old. And they're with their parents, and they're walking on a trail, and the parents say, yeah, they were right behind me, and gone.
Tell us, give us a story or two. This is, I know, if you've heard David before, you've heard some of these kinds of things. But they are, folks, parents, please, don't ever let your child more than 4 or 5 feet away from you, and keep your eyes on him or her at all times. And I would suggest, if you're going for a hike and you got a little toddler, get one of those little toddler leashes. Tie it to yourself. And that maybe sounds silly, but it isn't. They've got them. We got a break coming up here, David, so we'll do that right after the break. Come up with a couple stories for us, if you would. The new book is called Missing 411. What does 411 mean again?
Well, 411 was the title for the first two books, and that happened to be the number of kids or people that had disappeared, and we had documented in both those books. But since then, we've gone up over, say, 650 documented cases now.
All right. Well, there you go. Stand by. We'll be back with David Paulides in just a couple of minutes. And that's Paulides. Book is Missing 411, North America and Beyond. Coming up next with David. Thank you. National parks, hiking, camping out, picnics, barbecues, wonderful. But if you go for walks with children, please keep them either in hand or keep them in front of you where you can watch them at every moment. Don't let them run off 20, 30 feet in front of you. Tell us a story or two, David, please.
So, just so everyone can keep this in mind, animal attacks, abductions in the woods by animals have been eliminated in these cases by search and rescue teams who bring in canines to search for things like this. And if someone is taken by an animal, there's usually a scene there where there's blood, hair, there's a drag mark there where the individual's drug away, there's screaming usually.
Of course, of course, of course. Got it.
All of that is eliminated.
Yeah.
So one thing that came out to us right away is when we started to document these cases, these clusters are not clusters one or two cases a year or one case every year for 5 or 6 years, because for some reason that would draw attention to the fact that these exist. These are cases that happen in a certain area, mm-hmm. and then 15 years later, another case exactly like it, mimicking it, happens in the same area. But there's enough time span there mm-hmm. where maybe the investigators working the cases either aren't working in those areas any longer, or the people working in those areas don't have any knowledge that this has occurred before. As an example, June 14, 1964, Dennis Martin in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park was up in an area where they had hiked in with he, his dad, his brother, and his grandpa. And they were spending a Father's Day weekend up in a meadow. Mm-hmm. There's no roads in the area. Kids were kind of running around having fun. As they're doing that, a second family walks up and says, "Hey, can our kids participate with you guys?" He says, "Sure." They introduce each other. First in many odd coincidences in this case, in the middle of nowhere, this other family introduces themselves as the Martins. So here they are, the two Martin families now, with their kids playing together in this meadow.
Mm-hmm.
They decide to play hide-and-seek. Dennis, 6-year-old, goes and hides behind a bush right on the fringe of the wilderness. His dad watches his son go behind the bush. For some reason, he told me, he goes, "Dave, I just watched it because I just felt something was a little odd." After everyone comes out from playing hide-and-seek a couple minutes later, Dennis doesn't come out. His dad walks over to the bush. His son's not there. This is directly adjacent to the Appalachian Trail. Mr. Martin took off at a dead run for 2 miles down the trail. Came back, couldn't find his son. His dad, Dennis's grandfather, ran down the mountain to get help. Within an hour and a half, there were 50 rangers on the scene. Within 2 hours, it started to rain, and it rained for the next week. Literally raining for the next week, and many of the search and rescue operations had to stop.
Mm-hmm.
There's two cases in 630 that we investigated where the Green Berets showed up on the scene to do search and rescue, supposedly, maneuvers. And mm-hmm. Dennis Martin's case was the first one we could find where, out of the blue, big helicopters flew in, they landed at a field, and the Green Berets set up their operations there. And I spoke to a retired head tracker for the Park Service, Dwight McCarter, about this because he was there.
Mm-hmm.
He says it was very odd. He said they set up their own communications network. We offered to assist them, say two of them and one of us, and we'll search the mountains together since it was in our backyard. They said, "No, we'll search alone." The park rangers in June of 64 didn't carry weapons. The Green Berets did. Now, I filed three different Freedom of Information Act requests against the Army, and I knew the unit of the Green Berets that showed up there and their commanding officer's name. Three times, it's not that I didn't get the Freedom of Information request back. They completely ignored it. I couldn't get anything, not even a response.
This
Make
is
a long story short.
Yeah.
Mr. Martin searched for his son for 6 weeks. Formal search went on for 10 days. They didn't find one shred of evidence of Dennis Martin ever. Now, there were witnesses that saw something strange about 2,000 feet below where Dennis disappeared. A family was walking up a valley, heard an enormous sickening scream. That was their words.
Uh-huh.
They looked up, and their boy, 10 years old, said, "Dad, look, there's a bear up there running between trees on the mountain." His dad says, "No, son, that's not a bear. It looks like a man." And it was dodging in between the trees.
Uh-huh.
They went home that night. They didn't realize a boy had been abducted. The next day, in the Knoxville Times headlines, boy abducted, blah, blah, blah. The family put it together. Said, well, maybe we saw something. They contact the FBI, which they said were involved on just a periphery watching mm-hmm. the case.
Mm-hmm.
FBI said, don't come to the park. We'll meet you someplace else. They met with them, told them what happened. They said, don't worry. It's nothing to do with the kidnapping. Well, Mr. Martin was never told of this, and he found out 3 days later from a newspaper man who happened to hear about it because they knew a family friend of the family that saw this.
Huh.
Mr. Martin hasn't talked to the press since this event happened and won't talk to the National Park Service since this event happened because he was lied to so many times on this case. I got a 15-minute interview with him, and I asked him a series of questions. I said, first of all, what about this case never made the press that I need to know about? He says, well, Dave, you know a lot about it, obviously. He says, you know the family that saw this thing up on the hill dodging between the trees? I said, yeah. He said, what'd the article say? I recited what it said. He said, one thing they wouldn't put in the paper, and the Park Service wouldn't even talk to me about it, is that they saw this thing on the mountain having something on its shoulder when it was dodging between the trees.
Possibility of Bigfoot?
I have no idea. I will tell you what the Park Service tracker said to me.
Mm-hmm.
So we got this information, and then I said, well, what else did they say? And they said, well, you know that there's about 7 or 8 different people over a 20-year period that disappeared in or around the parks and were never found. I said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, do you know the name of the FBI agent that was on the scene in each one of those incidents?
Mm-hmm.
I said, I do. He goes, do you know what happened to that agent? I said, no. He committed suicide.
Everyone?
And there was only one that monitored each one of these cases, and that agent committed suicide. Now, I went back to the tracker for the Park Service, told him what Mr. Martin said, that everything he said is true, Dave. I said, so what did they see on the mountain? Dwight McCarter said, well, you're not going to hear about this from anyone, but I'll tell you the truth, is that there's a group of wild people who live off the grid, that go into the park and steal and do bad things, and every once in a while they attack a park ranger, and they wear furs over them that they kill animals with, etc., to keep warm. This is probably what they saw on the hill.
Okay. Now, was this individual described as, did we get a description that was very tall, 8-9 feet tall, or normal human size? Did anybody talk about that?
There wasn't a size ever given, and it was at a distance of probably 50 to 100 yards.
I heard a horrible scream. People have recorded Bigfoot screams or alleged Bigfoot screams, and they're pretty horrible. I'm wondering if this is a possibility. I guess we can't discount it. I don't know. Very strange. Because Bigfoot, when it kills deer, slings it right over its shoulder. That's what they do. Eyewitnesses. Back in a minute. Hold on. Latest edition, North America and Beyond. The description of this thing, these were called wild people living in the mountains?
Correct. He said that there's a group of people that live in the woods around the park that live off the grid, live off the land. They're dirty, they're filthy, they use furs to put around them to keep them warm.
It sounds like cavemen. Could this possibly be Bigfoot?
Well, again, I'm not somebody that's going to discount anything, but
right.
I kind of report facts, and coming from the head tracker from the Park Service, both cases are unsettling, especially when he admits that the Park Service will never talk about this. And in fact, he talked about an incident where a National Park Service ranger was attacked by one of these things and almost killed. And, He says they know that they're there. They interact with him occasionally, not purposely, and that they're dangerous.
It could be an overlay of Bigfoot there, in my view. By the way, David, I know someone who was a former director of Yosemite, and I offered to give him your book, the red one. Was it red cover? I forget which edition that was.
Oh, the orange cover, Missing 411 Western U.S.
Yeah. I offered to give that book to him. Talked to him on the phone. I said, this is very, very interesting. And he didn't want anything to do with it. And he's retired. No, they're all, we do our best, and everyone's just totally devastated by these things. And I assure you, there's nothing strange that can't be explained by normal circumstances, and I'm not interested in the book. So there you go.
Wow.
Something about the National Park Service and its employees at the higher levels, maybe even the lower levels, is focused in on keeping this thing quiet for whatever reason. And I don't have the answer for you. But he did not want to. I live near the guy. I dropped a book by. Take a look at it. Fascinating. No, thank you.
Kind of an unusual response, huh?
Very. I mean, the guy's retired. He said, yeah, I'd like to see it. Anybody would like to see it. He was the head of Yosemite. Sure, he'd like to see the book. Nope. So, that was duly noted in yours truly's memory banks. So, yeah, there's something going on here. Now, when you have tracking dogs go up into an area and they refuse to do what their whole MO is to do, and that's to track, that's weird. Tell us a story about that.
Well, there was a boy. First of all, I'm going into a lot of age stories, but understand that these incidents are occurring today. The most recent incident occurred less than 30 days ago up in Washington near Wenatchee when a retired professor disappeared. I won't go into that case, but the most probably one of the more obvious unusual cases involving a dog occurred in Rocky Mountain National Park in 1938. A boy was walking along a trail. This is just what you were saying earlier, Jeff, where he's right behind his parents. Five-year-old boy, they turn around, he's gone. And they're about 40, 50 feet from a river. They're not near enough where he's going to just run to it and jump in. And this river isn't so big that you and I couldn't cross it on foot. It's fairly small. It's called the Roaring River. And he disappeared. So initially, the Park Service did what most people would probably do, is think that the boy fell in the river. They got permission from the National Game Service from that area. They dammed the river. And this was a big undertaking. So for 2 miles downstream, they used probably 1,000 volunteers and National Park Service people.
Wow.
They searched for a week. They never found the boy. And they had brought canines up, and they started at the point where the boy was last seen, and the canines searched up into elevation to a point where this trail forks. And one trail goes sort of to the west, and one trail goes to the north. And at that point, the dog laid down, which is a highly unusual response, considering that there was nothing there for the boy to disappear to. There wasn't any river right there. Well, as all this is going on, there's a husband and a wife that are coming back from a week-long backpacking trip in an area very near there. And as they're walking along, they just decide to take a break, and they sit down, and they hear something a couple hundred feet above them in a cliffy area. They can't believe that they're hearing anything, but they get out their binoculars, and they look, and there's this little boy sitting on a rock ledge 200-300 feet above them in an area that is ungodly. They said there's no way a boy could ever get there. And
sitting there, upright, conscious.
Yes, sir. And they thought, wow, that's weird, but they walk down. They didn't know a boy had disappeared. And they get down to the bottom, and they see 1,000 people there. Well, they lived in Denver. They went home, and the next day in the paper, they see this boy's picture on the front page of the Denver Post. They can't believe what they're seeing. This boy's reported missing. They go back to the park, and the National Park Service separates the husband and the wife because they think that these two might have abducted the kid somehow. After they figure out that they played no part in the abduction and they're good people, they figured out that where these people saw this kid is an area called Devil's Nest. And something I write in my book is an abnormal amount of people disappear in areas with the name devil in them. I don't know what it means, but there's a coincidence there. And the National Park Service says, well, this is impossible because no kid 4 or 5 years old is going to be able to work their way up into this most rough part of the park. So they get together 20 of their best climbers, and they work for 3 days with carabiners and ropes into this area.
Wow.
They find nothing. And the long and short of it is Alfred Bielarts is his name. And we got this information originally from a Denver Post search, subsequent from a Freedom of Information Act request specific with name and date. They were able to give it to us, justified everything I just told you.
Wow. Okay, as you said, these things are going on. These aren't all historic cases. They're happening now. It is the summer. Are you networked in to some people who keep you apprised about this, or is it just a search on the internet for missing people? How do you do it?
You know, I'm pretty fortunate because I put my email address at the back of every book I write, and I ask people to keep in contact with me. And the books I've sold, people are pretty passionate about this topic. They understand that I'm not trying to make something out of nothing. There is really something here. And we get hundreds of emails every week. And
hundreds every week. Wow.
Yeah, hundreds. A lot of them are just questions.
Yeah, sure.
But then it's all, you know, the way the internet is now, we can get all over the world pretty quick. And I hear of cases, and I've written about cases from Australia, Indonesia, France, England, and Canada. So it's not just here.
What parallels exist between cases here and cases abroad? Anything stick out?
First of all these cases are rural. None of them occur in a city. There's no chance of a vehicular abduction in any of these cases. No chance of suicide, no chance of animal attack. Swamps, for some reason, have a consistent application in many of these. Water is the second, but I'm not talking drowning.
Mm-hmm.
Berries. People are hunting for berries. They're around berry bushes. The people, when they disappear, a lot of times if they're found, it may be a warm day, and they're found with no shoes or with clothing removed. And they can't explain later on how that clothing even came off. And many times, if the person's found during the subsequent interview, they can't remember why they disappeared, how they disappeared, where they went, or how they were found. And one of the more unusual things is that a lot of times when people are found deceased, they're found in an area that had been searched numerous, numerous, numerous times, or they're found on a trail that search and rescue people took back and forth to that predominant search area every day.
They were dropped there, put there. Okay. Has anyone who has survived, and I don't know how many there are, undergone hypnotic regression therapy to try to find out what they experienced?
You know, that's exactly what we would look for. When we first got into this, we went to a few missing persons organizations, and we wanted to understand the protocol and how to work with people who had gone through something traumatic like this. And since we're not law enforcement, since we are just civilians at this point, we don't want to further cause these people mental harm by going into areas that may cause this. And one of the things that the people said from the missing persons groups is that we had to be very careful on our approach to people after an event like this. Many of them would believe or want to believe or unfortunately do believe that if we write a book about something like this after we interview them, that we're profiting from their loss and then we're victimizing them a second time.
I understand. Yeah.
So sure. If they contact us, that's an entirely different game. And we sincerely hope over time that people do, because we will do exactly what you said, Jeff.
Well, I think we have to have somebody at some point who has survived one of these events want to go through a little hypnotic regression to find out. That would be maybe the biggest door opener we can get. How many people would qualify as potentially available to do this if they wanted to? How many have been abducted? How many have been taken? How many of them have been let go? Missing shoes, missing clothing, whatever.
So So probably we've documented maybe 70, 75.
All right. Well, obviously the answer would be to contact every one of them and ask them if they would do it even for money. This has to be cracked. I'm not saying every one of them would suffer the same circumstances at the point of abduction. We don't know. But this is a very valuable tool, as you know, in some cases. So, well, anyway, congratulations on this book, Missing 411, North America and Beyond. What's next, David?
You know, you can follow us on our website, the Can-Am Missing Project, C-A-N as in Nora, Am, A-M as in Mary, missingproject.com.
Can-Am Missing Project.com. All right. David, thank you. I can't believe it's been 4.5 years since your first visit. I'll be here for your next book.
Thanks a million, Jeff.
You bet. Great to talk to you again.
Take care.
Good night. David Politis, and again, if you go camping, don't let your kids out of your sight. I mean, 5 feet away, 6 feet, that's it. All right. Back with you tomorrow. Take care.